Tonight on Arena, we look at the weekend's Oasis gigs, get lessons in revolution at the Dublin Fringe, and talk to filmmaker Ava Victor about her hit Sorry Baby. You can text us on 51551 tonight. The email is arena@rte.ie, and you'll find us on X at RTE Arena. Now, if you can, cast your mind back to last summer when the weather was a little damp. It was drizzly. Tickets for the Oasis gigs were released. It summoned one of the most feverish, emotional roller coasters of highs and lows amongst people very close to me, as people got closer and closer in those interminable online queues, only to either be thrown out or hit with dynamic pricing, a phrase many of us hadn't heard prior to that. The lucky ones got off sweating with their maxed out credit card, burning a hole on the table and wondering if it was all going to be worth it. Well, the weekend just gone, we found out whether it was or wasn't. Noel and Liam, the Gallagher brothers, rolled into Dublin for two nights at Croke Park. We have forgiven them for the horrors of dynamic pricing, or have we? Were they any good? John Marr was there for Arena and joins me now with his thoughts on the show. John, remind us of when they last played in Ireland.
It was headlining Slane in 2009, one of the last shows they did before the most acrimonious of splits. In fact, a split so bad, many people thought they would never be able to bury the hatchet and reform. But they did, and they were they created a buzz in Ireland, particularly in Dublin, last week, that the only thing I can compare it to was the arrival of Taylor Swift last year. And in fact, the Oasis bucket hat was the friendship bracelet of 2025. And I did not sport one in Croke Park on Friday night. And I felt like one of the few people who wasn't wearing either that or the kind of Adidas sanctioned tracksuits or
the Bohemians jerseys.
The Bose jerseys with Oasis emblazoned across the front. There was just such an incredible atmosphere in Dublin over the weekend. And the atmosphere at Croke Park, from the moment that the Owl Triangle started, which was sort of a bit of intro music, to the end of Champagne Supernova, was like nothing I have seen in that stadium before, because it didn't relent. I was sitting alongside a bunch of critics in the lower deck of the Hogan Stand, and from the first moment to the last, we didn't take our seats. Everybody was on their feet. And actually, what was completely remarkable, where I was, nobody was getting up to go to the bar. Everybody was just was glued to the ground or to the floor in front of them. And I mean, in fairness to the band, they just created a two-hour set that was as crowd-pleasing as you could want.
Talk to me about the audience. All I know is what I've seen on social media, pictures that I've seen in newspapers over the weekend. Your presumption is always that a chunk of the audience are going to be people who loved them first time round and now have a few more miles on the clock. What was it like?
It was a great mix. I mean, you have people like me who were 19 when Definitely Maybe was released in 1994, getting quite emotional about, I mean, being professional as well, but also thinking of exactly where I was when I listened to Definitely Maybe ad nauseum, walking the streets of Dublin. And then you had a lot of people who weren't even born when What's the Story, Morning Glory, the biggest selling British album of the 1990s, was released in 1995. And both sectors were completely enraptured by what was unfolding on stage. And Oasis very wisely decided, this is a nostalgia trip. We're going to revisit our imperial phase. We're going to look back to 1994, 95 and maybe 96, and we're going to play pretty much exclusively from the first two albums and this brilliant B-sides album, The Master Plan, which they released in 1998. There was one song, Little by Little, which was played, which was the only song from this century that was there on the Friday night. And to be honest, on the Saturday night, I should say, the last night's show, I think, was almost identical in terms of set list, as has been the case for pretty much all of this tour. There's been very little deviation in terms of what they've played. And yet it felt special, even though there was a sense of choreography to even some of the banter that Liam came out with, we kind of have heard this before. If those of us who have been avidly watching the shows in Cardiff and Edinburgh and Manchester and London, so there was maybe not as much surprise as might have been the case. But the fact was, they played better. They play better now than they did in the 90s.
I want to ask you about that, but I want to ask you about the set list as well, specifically. Why do you think they kept it so tailored to those albums? In terms of, because when a lot of bands come out of, call it retirement, or come out of it busting up, if you will, there is always an element of, we will play something great from all of our eras and from many of our albums. Quite a lot of bands either bring new albums out or bring out greatest hits with an added track or two. There's none of that here.
None of that here. I mean, and look, Blur played and had a great album, The Ballad of Darren. Pulp came out with a new album this year, put a fine show in the Three Arena. Oasis didn't even bother with a new song. I think they looked very clinically at their career and realised, as we all know, that the first two albums are easily the best albums that they made. And a lot of the albums they made this century are completely forgettable. So they realised, no, let's just play the hits, as brutally as that. And they played 23 songs on Saturday night. And every single one of them had this connection with the audience, in that it was, the words were sung back perfectly. There were moments where we're kind of humming the guitar parts. It just didn't let up in terms of intensity. Even at the points where Noel is kind of stripping things back and he takes lead vocals on something like Talk Tonight, for instance, there's still this energy within the crowd, 80,000 people, that I just hadn't seen before. I mean, even like, for instance, you look at something like Coldplay. They played 4 dates there around this time last year. And there were some very fine moments in that, but also moments where people are going, I need to go in and get a drink, or I need to do X, Y, or I need to be on my phone sending texts or whatever it was, or uploading to Instagram. And this time there was very little of that. People were just enraptured by the I suppose, just the buzz that had been created and sustained.
Even to the point where, and people may or may not have seen this, but on Oasis' own Instagram, they managed to capture people who were out on Jones's Road, outside of the stadium, who didn't have tickets, who didn't manage to get in, but were listening to the gig, and they were also part of the chorus too.
They really were, and that's been a feature of this Live 25 tour to date, particularly in Manchester, where you have a hill overlooking Heaton Park and you have thousands of people gathered there as well. And you know, I saw those that footage too, and the sound sounded pristine out in Jones's Road as well. And
why were you paying 400 quid a ticket?
Exactly, to be on the pitch for that, with, particularly if you're a female, with some incredible cues for bathrooms, it has to be said. But I just think it was one of those shows that people really wanted to be part of. And if I think of reformed bands over the past 20 years or so, the only act I can think of that generated this kind of excitement in terms of advanced ticket sales was Led Zeppelin. Celebration Day, that one show they did in London, where there were 20 million ticket applications from around the world. I mean, Oasis could have played seven consecutive nights in Croke Park, and you would still have ticketless fans. Mm. There was just that kind of demand.
I'm going to just play a little Oasis. I'm conscious we've talked for 10 minutes now and not actually heard any of the music. Let's do Cigarettes and Alcohol. Just in case you don't know, that's Oasis, Cigarettes and Alcohol, here on Arena on RTE Radio 1. John Marr was at the gigs and he's still with me. Talk to me about the sound in Croke Park, John, because occasionally the sound can be well worthwhile and it's well put together, and very occasionally, I think the last time I saw Bruce Springsteen play there, it was woeful.
Yeah, I was going to say that when I saw Springsteen there, it was bouncing back off the Davin stand, and it just was like, wow, this doesn't work well at all. I think it depends on where you are in the stadium, but also I never really learned about acoustics there, about what works, because like, again, to mention Coldplay last year, the sound was very good there. I think they've kind of mastered it, and there were no issues on that front. Like, from an audiovisual point of view, Oasis had this extraordinary big screen that went pretty much the entire width of Hill 16. It was incredible high definition that was showing them, you know, up close and personal, but also interspersed with all kinds of footage of the band from back in the day.
Newspaper headlines?
And lots of newspaper headlines. I mean, loads of them, says me as a print journalist, very pleased about that. But they were celebrating their own legend as well. And unusually for a modern rock band, everything was confined to one stage. There were no secondary stages. Mm. There was no vanity ramp. There was no jumping into the audience. There was no Bono antics, let's put it that way. In fact, as I made this point to somebody that the six main people on stage were in a position, a rectangle about as big as you'd see in front of the goals at Croke Park, typically during a hurling or a Gaelic football match. And they didn't deviate from that. But then there were some of the classic Oasis things. I mean, Liam still is the most consummate of frontmen. You know, he still has that simian strut. He is wearing this kind of the short parka. It's a really balmy night. It doesn't come off. The sunglasses are on for most of the show. And he looks great, by the way. He looks really fit and healthy, and you know he made the point that this is the soberest he's ever been in Ireland. I think he quipped that it was when he was a kid was the last time he was as sober as this. He was copiously drinking a water bottle, and he sounded great. And I saw him play the Three Arena last year. He was doing Definitely Maybe in its entirety, and he sounded so good. Mm. Because I remember seeing them way back when in the mid-90s, and his voice could be very ropey. And the band themselves could be kind of all over the place. This is a very well-honed machine now.
Yeah, there seems an enormous irony about Oasis being performing at the absolute best of their abilities when they're perhaps at their soberest.
Indeed. I mean, all this talk about cigarettes and alcohol, a lot of that has been eschewed by this band for sure, you know.
I want to ask you about Liam and Noel together, about their interactions with each other. I saw, again, pictures in print newspapers over the weekend of them holding hands, coming out together. Yeah. What's the mood between the two of them like on stage?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, yeah, they do make a point of the arms are held aloft, the hands are clasped, and Noel certainly is making more of an effort, I think. But I wonder how significant that bond is really, because there was no interaction verbally between them. And
no back
they
and forth,
arrive
no
in separate cars, all this kind of stuff. Apparently they were staying in separate hotels. No back and forth as there would have been in the old days, shall we say. And I get the distinct impression that Liam is really trying harder than Noel. And I think, as has often been the case in the history of this band, it was Liam who was the problem. Liam who was causing the friction and who was not turning up. He just seems like the most consummate professional imaginable now.
I know there are lots of clips available on social media and people have already probably seen them, but I want to take just a little audio from Noel. It may or may not have been recorded by a journalist of my acquaintance who's sitting immediately in front of me. But this is Don't Look Back in Anger. Let's just take a little bit of this to get an idea of what Noel was like with the crowd. Yeah, if you're an Oasis fan and you weren't there, that's fairly spine-tingling sort of stuff. I want to ask you about, and I hate to bring it up, but I feel like I should, the dynamic ticket pricing thing. Mm. Do you think that what you saw was worth what some people paid?
I do. I really do. Because I think when you really want to be at something that you won't forget, it's hard to put a price on that. Like, I know people that spent €500 or €600 to go to the All-Ireland final a few weeks ago and they thought it was worthwhile because their team won partly. But if you went to that show, you kind of won because you've got memories that will last a very long time. And particularly if you got there with mates, it was incredibly special. I mean, there's just a great memory of leaving the Hogan Stand. I'm on Jones's Road and people are singing the refrain of Champagne Supernova, which is the final song they played. And everybody just looked like they just had the time of their lives. And they kind of went along thinking, I really want to be entertained here. I really want this to feel special. And it did. Whether it was an 18-year-old who was seeing them for the first time and had kind of lived with them through Spotify, or somebody, a 50-year-old like me, who was trying to relive my teen years. And wow, I did.
Just one last question. Was there anything especially Irish about the night? Because as you said, you've seen some of the other gigs already, seen details of them online. Was there anything to differentiate it?
Yeah, there was. I mean, you had the Owl Triangle, Lou Kelly, very distinct vocals at the very start before the usual online music that they play. I mean, in Edinburgh, they were playing Born Slippy before that, which I suppose the train spotting connection was there. But so there was that. He mentioned Peggy, his mother. Liam did. They talk about Charlestown in Mayo, directly across the way in the Davin stand. There was a big Mayo flag draped. And Richard Ashcroft, who played a wonderful set beforehand, downed a pint of Guinness in one after the end of Bittersweet Symphony.
John Marr, thanks for talking to us tonight on Arena. Cheers. We're back after this. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Comedian Ava Victor's debut film, Sorry Baby, tells the story of Agnes, a graduate student in a New England college who's sexually assaulted by her thesis supervisor. Using wry humour and unflinching honesty, the film, which was produced by Barry Jenkins, gives a perspective on recovery from trauma that's full of kindness. Ava Victor wrote, directed and stars in the film as Agnes. I spoke to her earlier today, but before I bring you that conversation, let's hear a clip from the film. In this scene, Agnes is at the supermarket with her emotional support kitten, who she's just found at the side of the road.
Is this all for you today?
Yes, thank you.
Did you bring a cat into the grocery store?
No.
Yes, you did.
What did you say?
You're lying.
No, I'm not.
Is your cat food?
Ava Victor, you're welcome to Arena. Sorry Baby centres on the aftermath of a crime, but it's not a whodunit and it's not a whydunit. It's kind of a how to get over it film, which is quite unusual. Maybe tell me why you decided to go down that path.
I definitely wanted to make a film that focused on trying to heal from something difficult. And I would argue that maybe it's less of a how to get over it kind of film and how to put one foot in front of the other again kind of film. It's a very small degree of healing that I think can happen in the 5 years that we're documenting here. But it's very much a film about friendship and finding little joys in the world after when you're recovering from something difficult. So that was really the impetus for writing the film, was wanting to focus on healing and less on violence.
And I'm going to talk to you about that. Tell me first of all, though, about Agnes, about where she is in her life when we meet her first in the film.
Well, the film is broken into nonlinear chapters. So I very deliberately made the first chapter of the film present day and sort of joyful, romantic, intimate reunion between two friends. And that felt like the most important place to start the story, because the film is about a friendship. And I wanted the audience to feel they could experience laughter and joy with these two friends and meet them as they are now without having any sort of knowledge about how they got to where they are, so we can meet them fresh and we can feel them as whole people. And then we go back in time and we meet Agnes and Liddy, the best friends in graduate school, and then we move back to the present day into the next year after that. So time moves deliberately in a nonlinear way to build people as whole people, so you're not immediately confronted with what they've been through. It's more who they are.
Sure. You don't depict the assault on screen. Instead, it's recounted by Agnes in the immediate aftermath to Liddy, played by Naomi Aki. Can you talk us through that decision, maybe to you know, tell and not show?
Yes. It was never going to be something I wanted to show on camera. I didn't make a film about sexual assault. I made a film about trying to heal from that experience and finding friendship through it. So yeah, going inside the house was never something we were going to do. I wanted to not only protect my audience from having to see something like that, that could be very shocking to the body and can be something that puts up a wall between the audience and the film. But also I didn't want to put Agnes through that on camera. I wanted her to, in her own words, tell us what happened to her once she feels safe enough to use her own words. And I think in the real world, we don't get to be inside that house and have access to that image. In the real world, we hear people's accounts of things and we believe them at their word. And I wanted the film to believe her at her word. And I also think it felt quite cruel to imagine knowing what happens to Agnes before she knows. It was much more interesting to me to stay with her emotionally outside the house and to experience the emotional truth of that time and to not be able to make sense of it until she can.
Talk to me a little bit about how the story and the script for this came about, because I believe like a lot of films at the moment, it's a product of lockdown ultimately and consuming a lot of film. What were you watching at the time, and then how did that nudge you in certain directions?
Yeah, I hadn't really had a film education. There are things I grew up watching, like Singing in the Rain and A Hard Day's Night, that I played over and over on a VHS tape, but I really hadn't studied film in any formal way. And I, during COVID, was kind of sequestered in a house by myself or in an apartment by myself. And I really did fall in love with film. I felt like it was both at the same time an escape and also a sort of confrontation with my own humanity, and it made me feel present at the same time. So I was watching things like In the Mood for Love and 45 Years and Phoenix and La Strada and The Heartbreak Kid. I was really throwing myself into the experience of being a film goer. And I felt very moved by what I was seeing. And I wondered if I could ever do that. And there was also this burning desire at the same time to try to figure out how to tell this story in the way I wanted to. And it took a while to build a skill level that met the film I wanted to make, and an awareness of how films happen and how films work in order to tell the story in the way I wanted to.
And this is at least sort of partially where Barry Jenkins comes into this story, because the film is produced by Barry Jenkins and by his company Pastel. They're a production house known for championing emerging filmmakers. Was he the person who wanted you to direct this film? You weren't necessarily going to be the director in the first place?
He sent me a message that if I had a script, I should send it to them. And I didn't have a script at that time. So I instead met with them, and he encouraged me to look at what I was doing online, which were very short comedy videos, as filmmaking. And that planted, I think, a little seed in me that maybe that was something I could do. And then I wrote this film and sent it directly to his company, and sent it to Adela Romansky and Mark Syriac. And they sort of championed me for 2 years and helped me discover how to prepare to direct the film. But it was very much my decision. They asked me to go sit with the idea of directing the film or just try to figure out what I wanted to do. And when I did that, I realized I desperately did want to direct the film. It was just that I didn't want to, I just wanted to do a really good job. And so then we spent 2 years figuring out how to put myself through training to feel confident enough to make the film that I really, really wanted to make.
It's quite wonderful that at the heart of this film, rather than an act of violence, is a love story about female friendship. I read that you saw Naomi Aki's character, Liddy, as the romantic lead of the film.
Definitely. I mean, I think the film is about these two people who have this seriously romantic, intimate relationship, and it's about how their lives move towards and from each other over the course of 5 years. And finding her was probably the most pivotal piece of putting the film together, because you have to fall in love with them for the film to work. And we luckily immediately had a real special chemistry that was sort of super easy. So I'm very grateful to her for believing in the film before she had any proof I could pull it off.
There are a lot of resonant scenes in the film. The moment where she encounters the sandwich shop owner as she's having a panic attack is beautiful. Can you tell us maybe just a little bit about that character? It's a very short scene, and the work that John Carroll Lynch, who people might know from Fargo, does in that role.
We're closed. You can't park here. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Look, I'm sorry I yelled at you. My kid Hank gets these breathing attacks, too, real bad sometimes. I know you're scared, but you're off the road, you're in your car, and you're okay. I'm going to breathe, and you breathe with me, okay? You just follow, all right? You ready? In. Out. Two, three, four, five. In. Out. Two, three, four, five. In. Out. Two.
Yeah, John Carroll Lynch. I wrote the scene that they're both eating sandwiches, and he said, "Well, I think he would make her a sandwich, and he wouldn't eat a sandwich." And I said, "Oh, are you sure?" I really liked that they were both eating sandwiches, and he said, "Well, when I was shooting Fargo, I was supposed to make us both eggs, but then I just made Francis eggs, and they really liked that." And I was like, "Oh, okay. So I guess that, yeah, you can just make her a sandwich. That sounds good." But he's a true force, and he is. It's such a gift to that he understood how important that scene was, and that he really took it on in such a big way. And it's a really, really special experience to get to 75% of the way through your film, like have a knock on a window and have a completely new face show up and a completely new energy. And I think it really allows, there's a real burst of momentum that he brings to the film that's very necessary. And it's really a scene about the kindness of a stranger and how sometimes a stranger can see you more clearly, and you can see yourself more clearly with a stranger than you can with other people. So yeah, it's a very meaningful scene to me. And I think it feels like if any scene in the film felt like the whole film in one scene, it would probably be that one.
Maybe just before we finish, Ava, Sorry Baby screened at Sundance in January to huge acclaim. You won the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award. What was it like first to take it to Sundance and then to have that, you know, because it is an expectation of success at Sundance after that?
I mean, I had only shown the film at that point to 30 people at a time, and we'd only done that maybe four times. So I had no idea what it would feel like to show it to more than 1,000 people on the premiere night. And it was, I mean, I completely sweat through what I was wearing and excuse me. And it was a very intense night. It was very hard for me to understand what was happening. And it's been a real ride. Like, I don't think anyone knew the film existed before that night. And it's been a real journey of inviting people to the film in different cities for the last 8 months. And it's a real blessing to get to make a film about feeling lonely that is meeting so many people on the other side. It's a real gift, and it's so rare. And I do feel very moved by its reception. So I'm very grateful for that.
Ava Victor, thank you so much for talking to us tonight on Arena.
Thank you for having me.
I was wondering, do you have like stuff that makes a fire?
Oh, matches?
No, like a liquid. Is that a thing?
Oh, yes. Lighter fluid.
Yes. Do you have that?
Yes. Why do you need it?
My friends and I were going to make like hot dogs.
Oh, hot dogs sounds good.
I'm sorry. We only bought two hot dogs.
Oh, no, that's no problem. I have dinner plans with my mom. That's not true. I'm sorry. I just wanted to close myself off from the possibility of being rejected.
That's no problem.
I'll get the lighter fluid.
Okay.
Do you want to come inside while I look?
No, sorry. Can I wait outside?
Yeah, don't worry about it. I'll be back soon.
That was Lucas Hedges as Gavin and Ava Victor as Agnes in a scene from Surrey Baby. It opens in selected cinemas on Friday. Personal and the Political come together in Lessons on Revolution, a show written and performed by Sam Rees and Gabriele Uboldi, theatre makers based in London. It comes to the Dublin Fringe Festival next month after selling out the Edinburgh Fringe in 2024. Lessons on Revolution is a documentary theatre piece exploring the role of the London School of Economics in the 1968 student protests from Sam and Gabriele's own point of view as recent students, wondering what the present and future of protest is. It's set both in their flat and in a 1960s lecture hall. And I'm delighted that Gabriele Uboldi is on the line from London. Before we get to the play itself, Gabriele, you're the artistic director of Undone Theatre Company and Sam is an associate artist. Tell us a little bit about the kind of theatre that you both make.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. We make theatre that is political. I think that is the main kind of theatre that we make. And we do political theatre whilst also being experimental in terms of form. So we like to kind of challenge the expectations of everyone that walks through the door, read, and hopefully by the end of the show, that people will have changed their minds, really.
You, yourself and Sam, Lessons on Revolution came about as an idea from where exactly?
Yeah, so Sam and I met while we were doing the same master's in London, and we had a terrible experience during that master's because it was during COVID. And so, and at the same time, we were also flatmates as well. And we were living in this terrible flat in Camden. We were really experiencing in first person the terrible effects of the housing crisis. And so Sam and I met on the master's, and we quickly realized that we had similar political ideas. And so we were trying to figure out what we could do about the situation that we were in, both in terms of being students during this terrible time and also in terms of the housing crisis. And so we started to look for inspiration in terms of what people had done in the past when it came to difficult situations. And so we found some inspiration from the voices of 1968. And we quickly realized that there was a very local story to us. We lived in Camden at the time, and we learned that one of the biggest moments of protest happened in England in just at the London School of Economics that was around the corner. So we went there and we tried to figure out what happened in 1968.
Tell me about that, because it's not something I'm familiar with. Why did the students at the LSE have that sit-in protest in 1968?
So at the time, they had a new director that was appointed. This was Walter Adams. He had been the director at the College of what was then Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. So this was an apartheid state. And LSE, even at the time, was a very international university. And all of these people, all of the students that were at the university didn't want to have this connection with an apartheid state. And so they began to protest against the appointment of Walter Adams. And this was what the protest was originally about. But then it became about so much more. It became about the Vietnam War that was happening around that time. And all of these different types of activism that were becoming more and more important at the time. For example, the foundation of the London Gay Liberation Front that had a connection with LSE in 1970 as well. So really, it's about solidarity between all of these different groups around 1968 at the London School of Economics.
I've seen the 2024 version. I'm conscious it's quite hard to explain exactly what happens throughout the show and the kind of structure of it, but maybe give that a try.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing is that I think the space is a good way to start, really. As you said, the theatre that you walk into is, we turned that theatre into our flat, Sam and I's flat. We welcome people by giving you a biscuit and a drink. But at the same time, we also turned that space into a lecture hall from 1968. We kind of want to recreate the experience of being part of an occupation in that way. And so we jump between all of these different timelines. And the show is partly about the process of making the show as well. Sam and I are in the show as characters, telling you about all of the different journeys of reading research, the people that we met, the documents that we read in the archive, and how those different documents and those things that we learned from 1968 impacted the situation that we were in. So it's about connecting all of these different times and spaces in the theatre space.
Yeah, they're lovely moments of humour and of human error in the story as well. And you're not afraid to show your workings. There's a visit to the archives of the LSE where things go wrong. Tell me a little bit about that.
That's right. Yeah. So the archives, I mean, maybe people think about archives. We certainly thought about archives as fairly inaccessible spaces, and we didn't quite know how to behave in the archives, really. We didn't know what was appropriate. And so we were just really excited about having all of these original documents in front of us. And at one point, we mixed up some of these documents. We didn't realize that we couldn't mix up documents from different folders. And so that's something that went wrong there. We accidentally exchanged some of these documents and had to apologise to the archivists there at LSE.
1968 is an interesting year to incorporate as part of this. I mean, people think of images of young people protesting around the world and throwing cobblestones at the barricades in Paris. But you call this show a show about a failed revolution and radical hope. Why so?
Yeah, so I think obviously some amazing things came out of 1968 in terms of the civil rights movement. So many groups that had been marginalized up until that moment began to have some form of liberation from 1968. So we don't want to downplay that, really. But at the same time, the ideas of 1968, those radical ideas, are all about revolution. They're all about going against capitalism, and capitalism has gotten worse since. They're against apartheid altogether, and we're still seeing apartheid in different places around the world. We're seeing it now in Palestine with the Israeli occupation. So all of those things didn't happen to the extent that the students at the time and the revolutionary people at the time were hoping they would. So to that extent, we think it's a failed revolution. But it's also about radical hope, because we want to kind of look back at this time to be inspired by the radical ideas of that time, and use the radical ideas of that time to inform the way that we can think strategically in terms of activism about the future.
There might be people listening right now and thinking that this might be something for them. Who do you think the show is for?
I think the show is for people that, like Sam and I at the time, felt very lost and didn't quite know what to do when things went wrong, when we felt that the world wasn't made for us, you know, whether that was because of the housing crisis or whether because we didn't felt respected as students at university around that time. But it's also, I think, something that has been really interesting about doing the show multiple times in different locations is that it's connected people from different generations. And I think it's opened up a lot of conversations between activists today and activists from 1968 and from many different times in between. So I think it's for all of these people that have some kind of connection to activism and have a desire for things to be better, really. I think that's the center of the show.
Are you looking forward to coming to Dublin?
I'm really looking forward to coming to Dublin. Yes, it'll be the first time that we take the show out of the UK. So we're very, very excited to take it there.
It's been lovely to talk to you, Gabriele Uboldi. Thanks for joining us tonight on Arena. Lessons on Revolution previews on the 9th of September at the Digital Hub ID8 studio at the Gate Lodge. And then it runs from the 10th to the 14th as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. You'll find more details at fringefest.com. And that's it for tonight's show. Produced by Sinead Egan. Our research was by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator tonight. And sound supervision is by Gard Duffy. I'm Rick O'Shea. And I'll talk to you again tomorrow night from 6:30. John Creedon is next.